This is episode 35 of the Great Speech Podcast on How to Network, an interview with Kingsley Akins.
Let's go.
It's a Great Speech Podcast for the public speakers. We're going way down deep to look at what makes a communicator. We'll look at all different topics from the bottom to the top. So get your mind free of all the distractions and please listen up, listen up, listen up.
It's the Great Speech Podcast.
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 Thanks, Dad. Welcome back. Welcome back, my great communicators. How you guys doing? I hope you are well. This is, of course, the Great Speech Podcast, bringing you another episode on all the good stuff related to communication skills. I am, of course, your communication super skills coach, Kolairi Shunaike. Scroll down, you'll find all the links if you want to get in touch with me for some communication skills help. But let's get on with it, because this episode, the episode this week is all about networking, the power of networking and how to do it. And although I do work and coach people on this, I think it's far better, and this is what I'm trying to do with this podcast, is to get the experts in, the ones who have gone all in on a particular topic. And this week I have with me Kingsley Akins, who is the CEO of the Networking Institute. Now, Kingsley has really dedicated his life, or much of his life, to understanding the mechanics, I guess the science, the theories of how to build your network. And he used those skills, partly what he developed from being a member of the Irish Trade Board, which is obviously all about connecting and networking and building networks for the country. He was awarded the CBE in 2008 for British-Irish relations. He also was the president of the Worldwide Ireland Fund, which is a fund I had certainly never heard of, but it turns out that it is massive. They, I think, have raised nearly 700 million or something, I think is what he said, in funds for Irish causes around the world. And they kind of use it by leveraging the Irish direct diaspora around the world and raising money for that. So it's really an incredible thing. And you'll hear a lot more about it during the interview. And he kind of uses his background as CEO of the Networking Institute. He was also founder of Diaspora Matters, which has worked with the World Bank and UNICEF in providing kind of programs related to diaspora work. And he really talks about the power of networking. And networking is one of those things that, which he explains actually, is when you talk to people about your network, people think positively. But when you talk about networking, it always has a bit of a kind of a sleazy undertone to it, because you know the way people network now, right? It's not really engaging. It's just saying, hey, this is who I am. Give me money or give me business. And I kind of dislike that stuff. So Kingsley and I really talk about how to network properly and effectively. He explains the link between networking and diversity, which is something I really had never thought about. He talks about why your weak network is actually better or more effective for building your network, building kind of the connections you need, than your strong network, which is something I hadn't thought about. And I like the fact that he talks about how you've got to audit your network so that you're using it strategically, not just kind of connecting with anyone and everyone without thinking about it. You know, he takes all the stuff he learned from his fundraising days with the Worldwide Ireland Fund. He also, what I liked as well is, so a lot of my clients certainly talk about the fact that they are introverts and that in their mind makes certain things communication related actually more difficult. But Kingsley flips that on his head and actually talks about and explains why he thinks that introverts are actually better networkers than extroverts. So, you know, kind of a lot of stuff. He talks about why networking isn't kind of the real reason he thinks networking isn't taught in schools. And we really approach networking also from a modern perspective, which is with COVID coming along, which means a lot of us have had to do things online, how to do that online effectively. And also why actually your network is your single most valuable asset as we emerge from COVID, when you're looking to build your career, whether it's because you need to get a new job or to build your business. So it's one of those episodes where we just cover a lot related to, I guess, the soft skill of networking, which, as Kingsley explains, is actually more valuable than the hard skills in this day and age as well. So there really is a lot in this episode. Kingsley's one of those guys that has kind of been everywhere, but stayed humble with it. It was only towards the end of the interview that he casually dropped in how he, you know, knows the Clintons and he had had dinner at Nelson Mandela's home, which he describes as one of the kind of the seminal moments of his life. And I love that, actually. I love the humility with which he approaches his work, knowing that he's doing good stuff, but not kind of bragging about it. So yeah, all in all, really, really good episode. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So kind of turn off all the distractions. Click the subscribe button if you haven't already, so you always get notifications of when the next episode comes along. But the main thing is tune in, because there's going to be some great stuff that you hear from Kingsley. So without further ado, here we go. Okay, welcome back, my great communicators, to the Great Speech Podcast. I'll be honest, this is take two because I had some sort of internet connection issue, but I'm pleased to say I have Kingsley back with me. Hi, Kingsley, you there?
Yes, certainly here. Yeah,
sorry for that mishap, but no harm, no foul, hopefully. Mm-hmm. As I say that whenever I start my recordings or my podcast episodes, I invite the guest to start the episode with a quote. So do you have your quote for us? And please tell us kind of what it is and why it's important to you.
Yep, I've got my quote all polished off here. And I was going to give you a quote in the Irish language, actually. My mother was an Irish language teacher at school. And I thought it might be particularly appropriate to the days that we're in right now. So the quote is Ní léinn hinton mar chinton féin, which basically translates into English means there's no hearth like your own hearth. I guess it is no place like home is what we would basically say. And I think at this time of the year, with kids migrating back from overseas, and lucky enough ours have been able to get back in. And certainly when I think back to my youth, it was always about, because I always was overseas, it was about getting back for Christmas. And I think there's something nice about that, this notion of a hearth, the notion of a fire, and the notion of being back in the hearth place.
Yeah, because you've traveled all over the world because of your work, right? And kind of worked in different countries and everything, but you still seem to retain that kind of connection to the home. And I know you do a lot of work on diaspora, which is obviously people that are outside of their home place. Why is it that that's kind of been something that's always drawn you back home? What is that for you?
Yes, and it's a great question in many ways. I'm not sure I have a precise answer, but it's always for me been the magnet. When I was growing up, this country was, we used to say it was male, pale and stale. It wasn't a very cosmopolitan place. In many ways, I couldn't wait to get away. My favorite road was the road to the airport. I lived in an island off the edge of Europe. So I was really keen to get out and about. But I found throughout my career, I always always had this kind of connection back. Lots of things I did in my work connected back here to Ireland. And then, of course, I was engaged, as you say, with the Irish diaspora, which is a very large, large international diaspora. It's about 70 million people. So in a way, even though I sometimes was away from home, I was pretty close to things that were connected to home. And, with friends, family and relatives and all that kind of stuff back here. And I was always, I guess I was really typical of many migrants. I mean, I left, ostensibly for a couple of years. It took me 22 years to get back. I was just a slow learner, I think. And I was intrigued by living in other countries and other places, trying to pick up other languages. All that kind of stuff intrigued me and excited me. Still does, by the way. And I still like that road to the airport, by the way. But, now safely, I'm in my third act and safely ensconced here in South Dublin.
Has Ireland become more diverse now, or is it still kind of that, pale and male? province.
It's incredibly diverse now. It's just nearly unrecognizable to what it was. When you think about, you know, we were for centuries an agrarian society. That's what we were, rural, agrarian, agricultural economy and society. And now we're a high-tech country. You know, agriculture, important as it is still, you know, nowhere near as important as tech and pharma and all these other areas. So, you know, and I worked for the Irish government for the IDA, which was the agency engaged with bringing in foreign investment into Ireland. And really, I think we rocketed from that very basic agrarian kind of society to one now which is much more urban and much more tech-based. So it's unrecognizable as a place and as a country. And even from when I grew up here, and one of the reasons I left was because I found it quite a closed sort of place, and now I find it incredibly diverse and open.
Has that kind of tech introduction, because I know a lot of big companies are there, right? Has that actually been a benefit for Ireland itself, or are they just using it as a hub and kind of, you know, taking their business elsewhere?
Well, I think there's lots of hidden benefits from it. I mean, one of the benefits in this last year is that our tax base has held up extremely well in Ireland. You know, because these foreign multinationals, you know, particularly the pharmaceutical space, you know, you've got the Pfizers and all these companies are here. You know, that's saved our bacon in many ways over the last year, and will continue to do so. But something else has happened as well. These companies have hired lots of Irish people, and then it spawned these Irish people going off and doing their own thing and setting up their own companies, having learned so much through the process of cutting edge, state-of-the-art manufacturing and research, etc. So I think that we have an mix now. We have, of course, those great, you know, Dublin's got the headquarters of Google and Facebook and Airbnb and LinkedIn. I mean, there's thousands and thousands. And many of these people actually aren't from here. So Google have 10,000 people in Dublin, 8,500 are not Irish, they're from overseas. Actually is one of them. They're young, they're smart, they're techie, they've better teeth than we have. You know, they're fantastic. So it adds enormously to the vibrancy of the city. Dublin is such a cool place to live these days. Whereas in the old days, your expression, male, pale and stale, summed it up pretty well.
Right. And you're still swimming every day in the outdoors, are you? That I know that's one of your kind of pastimes. I want to ask you about that. How do you do that in this cold?
Yeah, well, you know, with difficulty and not for long would be the answer to both those questions. It's more a ritual. I'm not a religious person, but it is a kind of a bit of a ritualistic thing, this notion of doing it every day. I will pack up now at Christmas and won't go back till about March or maybe April, but it's been a wonderful ritual. We haven't had many options of things we could do during lockdown, but we could just, because I'm lucky I live near the coast, go down there. There's a whole community of people there. I mean, I think it's quite funny because of lockdown and COVID and all these things, there's been a whole new fraternity have developed, but of course they've spent money on what we call dry robes, which is, I think it's a UK product, which is a kind of a very fancy, like a massive swimming dressing gown, if you like, but it's, you know, stylish, etc. So these people now are showing up in their dry robes. They've got wetsuits. They've got cameras on their head to check on their sports. Like they've got booties on their feet. They've got gloves. And, of course, all of us old dogs who've been doing this forever just completely turn up our noses, refuse to communicate with these hairy beasts who just take over and we done forever. So there's a lovely kind of snobbery involved in this thing.
So no networking in this particular environment, mate. If you don't have Speedos on, you're not welcome.
Exactly.
Great stuff. Well, listen, Kingsley, I really wanted you on here because I, as you know, with this podcast, I'm really trying to cover kind of every topic under the sun related to communication. And one of the most important, actually, which I just haven't covered so far, is about networking and how you interact with people to, I guess, build your network for, I guess, the good of your own career, your business, but also just the good of the world, right? It's far better if we are connected as a people than if we are disconnected. But as I say, networking isn't something, I don't know if there is a university course on it, but how is that something that you settled on and got into? Because it isn't something that is ordinarily taught or focused on from what I can see.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And it wasn't something I had any specific interest in early in life, because I think early in life, and certainly early in your career, you tend to have an organic network, which is dependent on your family you know, where your relatives, your friends, your schoolmates, your college mates, all that kind of stuff. And it just happens. You don't even set out to set up an organic network. It's just there. It happens. But as you progress through life, I think you have to become a bit more intentional about your network. You need to take action. You need to do something about it. And it was brought home to me when I ended up going to countries where I didn't know anybody. And I knew that to survive and thrive, I had to build a strong and diverse network. And of course, the world has changed dramatically. And just talking about the differences here in the city I live in here, now there's such diversity in the world. All the research shows that if you don't reflect that diversity in your network, you as an individual and you as an organization underperform. There's a concept called homophily. And homophily is a kind of fancy Greek or Latin word, which basically means we have this tendency to hang around with people who are just like us. You know, we go to school, we go to college, we play sport with them, we go on holidays with them. You know, we marry people just like us, and we produce more people just like us. But that's not what the world is. The world is incredibly diverse. So if you don't build that diversity in your network, you end up in a bit of an echo chamber. And not only do you know these people really well, you also know their views and you know their opinions and you know who they know. And there was some fascinating research done by an American called Granovetter, who said that your next job in life will not come from your strong connections, but will come from your weak connections. Because you know about your strong connections, you know who they know, etc. Your weak connections, that would bridge you into different types of groups, different types of organizations. And that was kind of a real motivation for me, was to make a strong effort to, you know, I say, seek out unlike-minded people, you know, seek out people who are very different from me, who look differently, sound differently, think differently from me. I'm a founder member of an organization called CASE, and CASE stands for copy and steal everything. And that was one of the things I learned, was figure out who does this stuff well. And I identified people who are really good, the countries I lived in, who are good at networking, and I hang around with them. I mean, there's an old cliche that says we are the average of the people we hang around with. So you hang around with optimistic people, guess what you become? Hang around with pessimistic people, guess what you become? But hang around with people who are good at networking, you know, it does kind of rub off. And I realized that, you know, great networkers in all the different countries that I worked in, they all had certain characteristics in common. You know, they work hard at it. They don't brag. You know, they don't keep score. They don't say, Carter, I did you a favor 6 weeks ago. You owe me one. You know, they actually think like farmers who plants a seed, waters, nurtures, and just knows that there'll be a harvest. So they know that their network is like a living, breathing thing. And if you don't look after it, like anything, it'll sort of wither and die. They're curious. They're great listeners. They, you know, they understand that there's two types of information in the world. There's formal information, and you can Google it and read reports. But formal information is available to everybody. You can't compete on what everybody knows. And informal information, which is nudges, tips, winks, suggestions, ideas, it all comes from your network. And I'm a huge fan of the notion that life is a game of inches. The difference between success and failure is minuscule.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because I saw that on your LinkedIn profile. I don't know if this is some, you got it from there or you've seen it. Have you seen the movie Any Given Sunday?
Yeah.
So the greatest kind of movie speeches, Al Pacino, where he does that whole monologue on you know, life is really about a game of inches. So I saw that. I wondered if you'd seen that as well. I love that.
I love it, and it's very powerful, and I think it's obviously true. And I discovered it because I worked for about 8 years for the IDA, which is the Industrial Development Authority of Ireland. And my job, I was based in Australia and covered that part of the world. My job was to bring inward investment into Ireland. And if we got a company to commit to setting up in Ireland, fantastic. If we came second in that competition, we got nothing, zero, nada. And the difference between winning and losing, or winning and coming second, was so often minuscule, wafer thin, tiny. Yep. So I'm a huge fan of this theory of marginal gains. You know, this tiny little incremental difference. In British cycling, I think David Brailsford, who's been such a genius for your cycling, you know, he's won so many medals in the Olympics, he's won 5 or 6 Tour de France, but he's broken down cycling into every single minute element of cycling and improved it by 1%, 1%.
Yeah.
Nothing.
I think even the shorts to make sure they didn't chafe so, you know, much and change that.
They bring the pillows from hotel to hotel for recycling.
Incredible. And I think Woodward used that for the England rugby team as well. I think that theory of marginal gains. You know, what's interesting in your description of networking is, I'll be honest, I think even myself, but I imagine a lot of people always thought of networking as just expanding your network, but with people of kind of in your circle, right, or in your field. Yeah. Whereas you talk about it actually as a means of extending diversity and bringing people that you don't normally hang around with into your network. That's a very interesting take on it. Is that something? Can you just tell us a little bit more about that? Because I really wouldn't have thought about networking in terms of extending diversity, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, look, we live now in societies and economies which are very, very diverse. And unless you take that action, you are going to end up, I said earlier, in a bit of an echo chamber, hanging around with people just like you. I think there's also a big problem with networking. In fact, there's a difference between the noun and the verb. If you say to somebody, you talk about your network, that sounds pretty good. But when you use the verb networking, wow, that is a sleazy, slimy activity. You're in a bar late at night. Somebody's flicking out business cards late at night. You know, you wake up in the morning and you find Collar's business card and the turn up of your trousers. This is just horrible. So there's a real image problem. It's about insincerity, inauthentic. It even sounds a bit dirty, you know. So there's some real sort of problems with it. Companies don't have strategies for it. People say, it's not my job. You know, it doesn't show up in the recruitment process. And yet everybody says it's really important, which is kind of interesting. But the problem is, you know, everybody says it's important but not urgent, you know. And here's the problem. We live our lives doing urgent things. But unless you put time aside and are strategic about this, and actually, I always recommend some action here. Unless you take action and audit your network, in fact, really look at your network and ask yourself a really brutal question. Is my network good enough for where I want to be? Most people don't do that. They just kind of slob along, you know, it just happens. Mm. Whereas those people who are more strategic and thoughtful and really spot where there's gaps in their network, realize that they had some great connections in the past and they let them slip, and that's an opportunity there. When people who take that approach to it, I think, are much more successful.
You built, I think, one of the great fundraising organizations. Was that in the US?
It's around the world, but it started in the US.
Right. Yeah. And so did you use that, the kind of principles of networking, for that work as well?
Completely. And, you know, it's where I really learned about all this stuff. I mean, I'm also a fan of a concept that nobody ever started a large organization. I mean, when you think about it, you know, $2 trillion company in the world, Apple Computer started in a garage. When 21-year-old Steve Jobs and 27-year-old Steve Wozniak stuck a few bits and pieces of a computer together and went out and sold it. You know, Ryanair started with one plane and 12 passengers. You know, Hewlett-Packard was two guys with $500 in a shed. Disney's first cartoon was in a garage. Amazon, Starbucks all started in somebody's front room. Facebook started in a dorm. You know, like, I love the concept. Nobody started a large organization. And the Ireland Fund's the thing we started with a dinner in New York to bring together the great, the good, and the Irish diaspora in New York. And the dinner was so unsuccessful, the only reason we had a second dinner a year later was to pay for the first dinner we had. $700 million ago. So, you know, I love the concept. Nobody started a large organization.
And when you search for information on that, one of the quotes that I always see, and I want to ask you about it, is you talk to within the organization talking about how they must dress British, look Irish, and think Yiddish. great quote. And, explain that to me. What does that mean?
Well, you know, when it comes to diaspora engagement, there's four countries in the world which are very strong. But the outstanding country traditionally has always been Israel. And, you know, Israel traces its diaspora back to the exile of the Jews from Babylon in the 5th century BC, I mean, right throughout their history. But over the last sort of 25 years, a whole series of countries have now realized that their diaspora represents an interesting sort of not just set of lost actors, but actually national assets. And that's part of You know, we in Ireland say we have the state of Ireland, which kind of lines on a map, but we have the nation of Ireland, which actually is a global notion. And so I've worked with Wales, I've worked with Scotland, I've worked with New Zealand, I've worked with Australia, I've worked with over 30 countries now, who are all beginning to realize, you know, we have an asset here. And because of technology communications, you know, you can now be hyphenated. You can live in Southern California, but be engaged back in Scotland or Poland or Peru, wherever it is. And because, you see, what's happened with the world over the last few years, it's now more important what you do than where you are, which is fascinating. And I think COVID has reinforced that. I mean, you know, I'm doing some work for the Irish Cricket Organization at the moment, and the person I'm dealing with is actually based in Poland, you know, but can be just as effective because of technology and because of this whole Zoom world that we're in. I've done 80 Zooms now. Somebody called me the other day. They loved it. They called me a baby Zoomer, which I thought was
that's a good one. Do you find Zooming kind of mentally tiring as well? I find that I'm more tired with a Zoom meeting than I am with the same meeting in person.
Oh, I totally agree. And by the way, they're nowhere close as replacements. I totally and utterly, I'm struggling and I'm missing the connectivity and particularly the serendipity of being out and about. But we are fortunate that we can do this kind of thing. Somebody else called me a Zimmer Zoomer. I thought it was a bit nasty.
Good one.
But my general point here is about, you know, this notion of nationality, the notion of state. You know, it's become a bit of a softer, more amorphous thing. Countries have soft power through their diaspora. I mean, I've done work with Nigeria, for example. You have a very powerful Nigerian diaspora around the world. They've issued diaspora bonds in Nigeria for people who can connect back and invest back in the country. I mean, the big transfers of money in the world are now remittances, which is people sending money. It's about $1 trillion a year if you include non-banking money, which is a significant amount of money.
Yeah. I mean, Nigeria, I always feel, hasn't done enough in that. I know Ghana's trying to do a lot more in terms of attracting diaspora back. But I really hope that is something that we extend far more. Mm-hmm. Why isn't network? I mean, you know, the power of networking. I'm going to be careful. The power of the network. I think you're right. There's a difference when you talk to people about network and talk to people about networking. But the power of your network is kind of everybody accepts that. So why isn't it something that is taught more at school? Why isn't it something that companies invest specifically in, as opposed to just rewarding those that are good at it and ignoring those that aren't?
Well, a few reasons. I think one thing, we have a tendency to mix up networking and sociability. We have this kind of assumption that somebody who's very sociable is a great networker. And this is something really fascinating and something I find groups, when I run these sessions with groups, are intrigued by when I say that actually introverts or people who are on the spectrum, on the introvert side of the spectrum, can be better at networking than extroverts. People find that hard to believe. But they do it with decency and authenticity and integrity. They ask questions and then they listen, which is the number one skill in networking. Whereas the extrovert is not a good listener, never asks questions, is looking over your shoulder to try and find somebody more interesting to talk to, and wants to wow you about things about themselves, about how great they are. So I think that's kind of straight off the bat, you know, a misconception about the concept that we have out there. Your other point then, no, it's not taught at school or college or at universities, mainly because, you know, academics don't like the topic very much for two reasons. One is it's a bit soft and squishy. And secondly, they're not very good at it themselves. So,
you know, I hadn't thought about that as a reason, but you're probably right. That's probably one of the biggest ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So, universities are fantastic for teaching information, for teaching knowledge, but not for teaching skills. But here's the world we're in. The information and knowledge that you learn now is going to be out of date, irrelevant, and, you know, gone in the next, you know, 3 or 4 years. But the skill of networking, you know, will last forever. One of the books, people always ask me, what do you recommend as a good book on networking to read? And I always recommend, you know, Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, which was written way back in the 1930s, you know, before the Second World War. But it's in every airport bookshop in the world today. You'll get this book. So what did he say that, you know, Canada has lived, you know, so well over the years? Well, he said a few things. I mean, just to think of a few of the things he said. He said the sweetest sound that anybody ever heard was the sound of their own name. You know, how interesting is that? You know, he said, you know, the smile on your face means more than the clothes on your back. He said, a really good question beats a really good comment. You know, he said, when you talk about yourself and your issues and your concerns, people think you're a bore. But when you let them talk about their issues and that, they think you're a great conversationalist. You know, and he goes on in that kind of slightly folksy way about it. But actually, it's wonderful because, you know, it hasn't changed all that much.
And one of the quotes he had, which I love, and actually which I use very much with my clients, is to be interesting, be interested.
Focus
on other people, ask them questions, listen deeply to what they say and engage with that.
And I guess
it works in that kind of, you, by making others feel good about themselves, they kind of reflect that back on you and feel good about you, which helps with your network.
Most important skill is to make other people feel important. You know, it's a very human desire we have. I'm a big fan also of a great American woman who lives in London called Nancy Klein. We've come across her, and she's got a book called Time to Think. And that's all about the power of listening, you know, and how you see listening as a form of activity. I mean, most people think listening is a sign of weakness, of not being an expert, of not knowing anything. But actually, you learn nothing when you're talking. You learn everything when you're listening, you know. And so she sees listening as a form of activity, listening not just to what somebody is saying, but what they're going to say next. Listen like an interviewer, you know, use open-ended questions that begin with who, what, where, when, why, and how. And, you know, I think it's and I was poor at listening, and you probably think that even now, but I was poor at listening when I was at a much younger stage. I really, all I wanted to do was get out there and impress people by what I knew. And it took me quite a while to realize, no, it's the total opposite.
So when the Kingsley Aiken book on networking is written, what would your kind of your top tips or your top approach or strategy be for people trying to, or who finally understand the importance of their network and want to build it?
Well, you know, I think it's particularly important now because we're going to hopefully exit from a health crisis over the next 6 or 9 months or even year, with the vaccines, et cetera. So hopefully we're going to exit. But I think we're going to enter into a massive global jobs crisis. And I think that companies are now having to reconfigure their staff structures, given what's going on. And individuals are going to have to reconsider their career options. And your network is going to be the single most important thing you have going for you in terms of getting your next job. So, you know, it's hugely important and very, very current that you do that. And so, although I haven't written the book, I have written it, but it's just in draft. I mean, I think there's some process that you can put in place. There's a process. I go into this in some depth about networking, about auditing your network, about asking yourself a really brutal question, which I think most people don't ask themselves. Is my network good enough for where I want to be in the next few years? And, you know, is my network good enough for when we exit from COVID? So I think that the only way you can find the answer to that question is actually to audit your network, to actually print off your network and really look at it. And when you do that, you discover three things. Firstly, you've got a load of redundant entries in there. Like I have a dry cleaners in Sydney or Chinese. I don't need them. They're gone. So you can clean up your network. Secondly, you can you realize you've got some real gaps in your network. You know, nobody in aircraft leasing or tourism or reinsurance or whatever. And also you discover that you had some terrific networks, people in the past that you knew really well, and you've let them slip. You just, nothing happened. You didn't have a row, but, you know, life got in the way. You went this way, they went that way, lost touch. So what I've been doing in lockdown, every week I ring somebody I used to know really, really well. So I'm up to about 80 or 90 people now I've connected with. And I, only have they moved on and up, you know, hopefully I have in some way. But I've learned a whole lot of things. And I picked up from exactly where I left off with those people. Didn't have to start again. And it's been terrific. And it's been really an interesting side effect of, you know, COVID. I also discovered...
And just on that, do you think about any particular method of making contact, or is it just, I make contact and see what happens?
Just make contact and see what happens. It's all about, how are you? You know, what are you doing? Haven't seen you, talked to you for 5 or 10 years or whatever it is, but just thought, we're all in lockdown. See, here's what's interesting about the period that we've been in over the last while, and this activity that we're doing today. And of course, it's not as good as in face-to-face personal connections, of course. But there's some advantages to what we're doing today. Firstly, we're not geographically restricted. You can talk to anybody, anywhere in the world for free. That is phenomenal. Secondly, you know, everybody's available. I'm always getting people ring me up saying, are you around next week? Of course I'm around next week. I can't go anywhere, you know. So you're available, which is fantastic. And thirdly, more people are spending more time online than ever before in history. So now you know where they are. And because of particularly LinkedIn, where 750 million people have told this company, here's my education details, here's my work experience, here's the food I like, the place I go on holidays, you now can find out enormous amounts of information about people. So, yes, it's not as good as the old days, but actually it's kind of pretty fascinating what this has allowed us to do. And when we go, I'm not going to say go back to the way things were, because we won't go back. We're going to go on to something different. I think we're going to have all our traditional networks that we had on face-to-face kind of stuff. But now we have this whole new tribe of people that we've connected with electronically through Zoom and WebEx and Microsoft Teams. So I think this is going to be a bit of a win-win.
I hope so. You know, the challenge, I think, is that you have a great ethos of networking, which is it's just expand your network, build it, connect with people, and listen. I think the concern I have is that I think 90% of networkers don't approach it that way. So on LinkedIn, for instance, through the lockdown and everything, I have had so many connection requests that are just immediately followed by give me business, effectively.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I do. You know, when can we chat for the, it's like, oh, come on, man. We hardly know each other.
Yeah.
You know, I connected with you because you seem to be connected to somebody who I do know.
Yeah.
Let's just see what happens. Or even when I get connection or kind of the chat, you know, or connection requests or something from somebody that I do know from the past, for instance, I kind of hold my breath because so often it's followed by, oh, hey, caller, can I just pick your brain on a legal matter, right? Or, you know, a communication skills matter. And it's kind of like, what happened to just connecting and just being in the network? And then if things happen, they do. If they don't, they don't. But it's good to be connected. Yeah. I'm a bit concerned about that. Do you share my concern or am I just being a bit old-fashioned?
I think it's a reflection of a big problem that we have that we're kind of storing up. And that's, it's business development, biz dev, as we say. How do you make biz dev happen when you cannot go through the old, more traditional ways of doing it? So I'm hearing this from companies all the time. They're saying our concern is our employees, our folk who are working from home, they're connecting with existing clients, they're connecting with existing people they know, they're not developing any new business. And hence, you know, people are trying to use whatever means they can to reach out and, I guess, get a sale. Because I think that's a real issue and a real problem. Secondly, is one of the things I'm a fan of, I call it funnels of serendipity. A random chance can change your life. You know, one introduction, one conversation can change your life, but they don't happen when you're at home like this. So I think serendipity is being starched out of our routines now. The random bumping into somebody at the water cooler, at the coffee station, on the street, none of that's happening. And I think that's a really big negative. And I'm a huge fan of serendipity.
So do you have any thoughts or tips on how to approach networking in the right way in this kind of online world we're forced to endure right now?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I did, because I wasn't particularly strong on online activity before this happened, my business went to zero overnight. So I was doing workshops and presentations for companies and governments all over the place. And I was getting on planes, I was flying off, and everything went to zero because all that stopped last February. So I was lucky enough, I wasn't a hairdresser or a taxi driver. I was able to pivot online. So I developed a presence online, and I started giving away stuff for free. And I started giving away every day. I'd give away a different networking tip. I did it for 50 days in a row. And what I noticed was that, you know, maybe a couple of hundred people were going on, but by the end of it, it was a few thousand. Now on LinkedIn, I put up these short videos of 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. I'm getting 10, 12, 15,000 people now going on.
Wow.
I've built up this kind of online following, as I say, And of course, there are people in there who are trying to flog me something. But I now have an online tribe following that I never had before. So as I said earlier, I think when we hopefully move on to the next phase of our business lives, I'll have both, you know. And I've discovered extraordinary connections and contacts through that online activity. So I think it goes back to this thing of, you know, personal branding, which is an interesting notion, which, you know, I'm always a bit nervous about because it makes you feel like a ton of beans or some tin of beans coming. But the reality is, whether you like it or not, we all are brands, you know. We all are personal brands.
Yes.
And, you know, and even not having a personal brand is having a personal brand, if you know what I mean.
Yes, yes.
So even if you go against it entirely. And so you have to think in terms of, you know, what is true and authentic about yourself, and you got to find ways to let other people know. And the technology is now there to do that, which is something pretty new and in many ways quite exciting.
Yeah, the point you make about not having a brand is having a brand. I always remember Steve Jobs did the whole, you know, kind of black turtleneck, you know, and jeans thing for his presentations. And everyone thought, oh, wow, how innovative, not knowing that he used to get them made by Issey Miyake, you know, tailored for him just to be that I am not corporate, even though, you know, he's running the biggest corporation in the world. But yeah, what's next for you? Because I'm going to say you've had this extensive career, you know, going through many countries and everything. What's kind of your future, do you think, in terms of what you want to focus on?
So, you know, I want to do more online training. I've just finished, you're a legal lawyer background. I just finished 10 webinars for one of the biggest law firms in London. I did it around the world, in Dubai and Singapore, etc. You know, the law is an interesting industry. They have to embrace the changes, the technology.
Oh, yes.
They have to embrace networking. So they're kind of sheepishly kind of dancing around the topic, because, you know, they're very pure and very skilled at what they do, but maybe not as strong on some of the softer skills. And it's interesting to watch. I mean, LinkedIn came out with a study there some time ago, said that, you know, people now in management regard soft skills as more important than hard skills. And that, you know, soft skills will allow you to emphasize and underline your hard skills. So I think that is going to be an evolution. There's going to be more and more interest. Ironically, as we become more and more, you know, AI, robotics and automation takes over, more and more we're going to need the soft skills, which is a funny sort of thing. So I want to build a whole business in this space. I've now developed all of this stuff on online training programs, and I focused on four areas. One is that whole area of networking, which to me is the glue behind all the other topics I do, whether it's diaspora. I also have an online training program on philanthropy and fundraising, because that's what I kind of did for 25 years.
Of course, yes, yes. So,
you know, there's a methodology around that. There's an interesting dynamic happening in the world now, which is called the intergenerational transfer of wealth. The world has become very unfair and inequitable, which means there's massive wealth at the high end. You know, at the extreme, three people in the world have the same wealth as the bottom 50% of the world, if you just think about that.
Yeah.
But it is pretty, at one level, pretty horrendous. At the other level, you know, the intergenerational transfer of wealth basically means, you know, extremely wealthy people have to decide what they're going to do with their wealth. Now, the one thing that everybody agrees on, you can't take it with you. We use an expression, there ain't no roof rack on the hearse. You know, you can't take this money away with you. So if you can't do that, you've got three options what to do with your wealth. Firstly, you can give it to your kids. And that's what's going to happen. Kids are going to inherit enormous gobs of money. But there are some people who say, you know what? If you give a kid $100 million when they're 21, you destroy them. You really destroy them. So maybe it's not smart to do that. Like Warren Buffett said, it's more important what you leave within your children than what you leave to your children. So he's going to give away all his money. So the second option is you can give the money to the government in tax. And sadly, people always want to avoid that issue, which is tragic because governments do great work and need money. But that's the reality of life. And the third option is you can give the money away philanthropically. And so this is going to be, we're in the early stages of a gigantic philanthropic explosion around the world. Not many people are kind of talking about this because we're looking at other things right now. So that's the second area I've developed online training in. Third area is diaspora engagement. So I work with lots of different countries. I said earlier, I just did something in Tbilisi in Georgia a couple of weeks ago, keynote address for all the Balkan countries who are all trying to figure out how do they connect with their diaspora. So that's an interesting kind of niche space. And then the final one I developed a training program in is in public speaking and presenting. Because I'm always interested in that.
Excellent.
And I think I said to you off camera earlier, I remember somebody in America saying to me, they said, never give a Mick a mic. I mean, the Irish do talk, you know? And so you need to shoot them to get them off the stage. But for me, the ability to be able to get up and speak convincingly and compellingly is an incredibly important thing to do. And it didn't come naturally to me. And I had some absolute disasters. And I realized, you know, I really had to spend time and work on this. I also worked for my boss for 20 odd years. It was a guy you wouldn't know him, I don't think, but he was a famous Irish rugby player. And he played for the Lions on a few occasions. He was a great, he scored more tries than anybody ever did. And he was head of the.
Who was that?
His name is Tony O'Reilly. And he was head of the HLA Heinz Food Company. And he was a total legend. But he was a phenomenal speaker. I mean, incredible speaker. And, you know, I just watched him around the world as he just chanted presidents and everybody. And, you know, I remember having a dinner with Nelson Mandela once, and O'Reilly was just sensational. And so I realized, you know, if you can be, and I've only ever been a mere shadow of that, but I've always realized if you can be at least proficient in that space, that gives you a huge advantage.
Wow. Yeah. You've just from listening to that, have obviously met a whole load of people. From your experience, who would you say, who stood out to you as somebody who had that aura that just attracted people and, you know, would you can tell from that they will just build an awesome network because they had that kind of charismatic or magical personality?
Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned having met Mandela in South Africa and had a dinner with him one night in his home. And that was really the most, that to me was the pinnacle of my life. I've never experienced that. He was such a humble, modest man who asked questions, who listened, and was cheeky and fun and irreverent and all those things. Really great. And then, you know, on the US side, I would have met all the politicians. I would have met the Clintons, gotten to know them over that period. Obviously, because there was a big engagement in Northern Ireland. So, you know, I was a big fan of the Clintons. I'm a Democrat by voting for the U.S. So I'm delighted Joe Biden's in. I would have got to know him when in the old days. He was terrific. And so lucky enough to have met various politicians in different places around the world. And then, you know, lots and lots of great business leaders, because that was the kind of model that we had in the U.S. We ran these events. I mean, we'd run an event in New York, and one night we'd make maybe $4 million. And it was a total machine. And that goes back to that line, you know, I was saying how, you know, when we set up this organization called the Ireland Funds to raise money from our diaspora to support projects, community projects in Ireland, we modeled ourselves on what Israel had done with the Jewish community. So basically, our model was, the Jewish diaspora support Israel enormously. Could the Irish diaspora do the same for Ireland? And Tony O'Reilly, I mentioned, a very funny speaker on that first dinner in the Waldorf Astoria. That was such a disaster. He said, you know, our slogan was peace, culture, charity, and we're going to change it to look Irish, dress British, think Yiddish. If we could get, if we could get those three things in alignment, we might be onto something. And of course, he was totally right. And that thing is now, you know, it's raised, I think it's, I'm now gone. I did 21 years with the organization, but we raised something like $700 million.
Gosh, so incredible. What would you say is the key or the one thing that really makes people willing to contribute or open up their checkbooks? What is it that kind of captures them?
Well, you know, there's two things I think that are really important. One is they have to have a belief in the mission of the organization. You know, if the mission of the organization is not right, you can't trick these people into giving money. And then the second thing is, who asks them? You know, the person who asks them is really important. And that relationship is really important. Because when you think about it, Colin, I mean, there's millions of great organizations out there, you know, and, you know, which is better than any, cancer better than dogs, homes are better than, you know, culture better than ballet, better than, you know, there's lots and lots of them, but it's a very, very big industry. And there is some process around it. I mean, I learned a lot because I was based in Boston and I got very friendly with the guy who ran fundraising for Harvard and their, the university in Boston, which is an extraordinary machine. Now, they have 800 staff in fundraising. So this is a
big, wow.
And there goes billions and billions and billions for Harvard. So I, one of the things I learned about that is that money is attracted by strength, not weakness, success, not failure. So if you go to a donor and say, you know what, if we don't get money by this Christmas, we're going to go out of business. The donor thinks you're not a very good business. So
right.
People support successful ventures.
Interesting.
Harvard has $35 billion in the bank, and yet they raise more money than anybody else because they're a very successful system.
Right. I see. Which makes sense. The person who asks and where they're coming from and how they're connected makes all the difference, which emphasizes the importance of the network. Wow, Kingsley, that is some fantastic information, valuable stuff you shared with us there. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I'll probably want to pick your brain even more longer, but I can't take up so much more of your time. So I really, really appreciate you sharing that with us. And if you're listening to this right now, do scroll down because you'll see all of Kingsley's links. He's got some great stuff in terms of the links and information that he shares, as you say, regularly. So do check that out. So Kingsley, listen, I'm going to take you now on to the 10 question quick fire round, which is 10 random questions. There is no right or wrong answer, and you don't have to agonize about any answer. Just say what comes to your mind. Yep. Okay, so are you ready?
Go.
Okay. Question number one, if you could get a LinkedIn connection request from any three people in history, dead or alive, who would they be?
Oh, right. I think I'd go with Brian Boru, who fought in 1014. We beat the Danes in the Battle of Clontarf. It was the last time we had a home victory. I was going back then. I think W.B. Yeats, who's a poet from my home county of Chicago, William Butler Yeats, wonderful poet. And perhaps the writer Edmund Burke, who is a parliamentarian and making reflections on the French Revolution, all that kind of stuff. They'd be my three.
Yes. I think it's Edmund Burke, or may not be, who said a thing has happened on which it is difficult to speak, but impossible to stay silent. Now, I think that was Burke. It may not have been, but it's one of my favorite quotes from that period anyway. But yeah, wow, three great choices. I like the way you came out with that quickly, even though you didn't have a heads up on the question. That's very good.
A bit worried about
okay.
A woman there, though.
Sorry, say again?
I'm a bit worried I don't have a woman there, so I might be accused of being a bit sexist. If you'd given me four, I probably would have gone.
Well, if you had chosen three average guys, then yeah, there might be, but nobody can argue with those choices, I think. Okay, question two. On a scale of 1 to 10, how nervous do you get before a speech or presentation?
Well, probably 7 and 8. Yeah, always.
Okay, all right.
Nervous, yeah.
Yeah, me too. Okay, question three. Love, wealth, or happiness? If you could only have one, which would it be?
I remember my dad once saying, he said, money won't make you happy, but you can buy a big Merc to go around looking for it. I suppose happiness, yeah.
Yep, okay, cool. Question four. A favorite album or favorite book or favorite movie or all three if you know them?
Favorite album, nearly Astral Weeks, Van Morrison. Okay.
Don't know that one.
What was the second one?
Favorite book.
I remember a book that influenced me when I was a student was called The Drifters by James Michener, which was about youngsters just going off around Europe in a Volkswagen van. That really struck a chord with me.
And favorite movie.
I'm a bit of an old traditional this thing, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, yes, of course. And I remember with that movie, I think they shot it where they died at the end, and I think the producers or the studio was like, no, they can't die. So that's why it cuts off and you never actually see them die.
Yeah, they just ran out of the place and there was...
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, question five. If you had to relive one day for the rest of your life, like the movie Groundhog Day, what day would that be?
Oh, listen, it was playing rugby for my college when we played up against the other college, and what, you know, it's a bit like an Oxford Cambridge situation in rugby. So,
right.
And we'd lost for years and years, and we beat them on that particular day. And I remember we were total underdogs, and it was such a glorious feeling of coming off the pitch and feeling, you know, that was a job well done.
That'd be a great day to relive. Great. Okay. Question six. If you could only listen, speak, or see, which would you choose?
See.
Okay, all right. I was surprised, actually. I thought it'd be speak because you were saying how you like to talk. Okay, question seven. If you had to choose one track, one song to walk out onto stage to, what song would that be?
One song. Downtown by Petula Clark.
Ah, okay. All right, cool. Okay, question eight. If you could live anywhere at any time in history, where would that be?
Do you know,
where and when?
Maybe here around 1780 to 1800, when this city was the second city of the empire, and we had these magnificent Georgian buildings. And so long as I was on the right side of the tracks, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It was a glorious and very fertile period of history.
Yeah, great. Okay, question nine. What was your favorite period of life? Education, kind of school, university, early work life, or now?
Probably education.
Okay, all right, yep. And final question, question 10. Which actor would play you in the movie of your life?
Which actor? Do you know that I did get to know one actor, I got very fond of, a guy called Gregory Peck. Do you remember that name going back?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I know Gregory Peck.
He was on our board in America. I used to spend a time with him. I just thought he was such a classy guy, you know?
He was, yeah.
To Kill a Mockingbird, all that stuff, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to get my kids to read that, actually. I'm not sure if they're ready for it yet, but yes. Okay, yeah, great answers, great response, very instinctive responses, actually. A lot of people can take ages. I'm like, listen, there's no right answer. Don't worry about it. So thank you for that. Listen, Kingsley, thank you so much for that, not just taking part in that part, but just everything you've shared with us so far. I think listeners will have got a lot of value, in particular in kind of thinking about the world, not just from the perspective of doing the work or what you do, but actually growing that network, increasing your diversity of influences as well. So that's really fantastic. People will no doubt want to hear more from you, get to know more about you or learn from you. Where should they go? Where's the best place for them to kind of either connect with you or see the stuff that you share?
Yeah, I think two places probably. Just my profile on LinkedIn, Kingsley Aikens, mm-hmm. LinkedIn, and then the www.thenetworkinginstitute.com would be our website. I have a very active LinkedIn presence. I'm always getting lots of people connecting with me there, and it gives me a chance to learn a bit about them as well. So I kind of like that option.
Excellent. Okay. Yes. Scroll down. You'll see all the links. But yeah, I think both are great places to go. So excellent. So final thing is to say goodbye. And when I have a guest, I give them that privilege to say goodbye in a language or dialect of your choice.
All right. Well, back to my mum. She used to say to us, "Gonairi on Bohar Lath," which means "May the road rise up in front of you." So that kind of works well, Jerry.
Excellent. I love that. Thank you very much, Kingsley. Really appreciate you sharing your time with us. Thank you, my great communicators, for listening again. I will be back in, I guess, a couple of weeks with another episode. I never know what it's going to be, so you'll find out then. See you guys later.
Thanks, Carl.